Happy Friday, everyone. It's time to read the Fort Dodge Messenger for Friday, December 20th, 2019. We are reading to you from our studio located at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. My name is Ruth, and my partner at the microphone's name is Skip. We're glad to have you listening. We will start with a look at today's weather and headlines from the front page.
Good morning. Dave Havlick, thank you for subscribing to the Messenger. It's going to be only 5 days till Christmas, and we're going to have a nice warm day today. The headlines are A Little Road Trip, A Trip of a Lifetime, and Rockwell City's Last Grocery Store is Closing.
And now for our first article, A Little Road Trip. 1915-era barn near Duncombe is moved to a new site and will be restored. After sitting in the same spot since it was built in 1915, an old barn in need of a little restoration got to go out for a drive through the countryside Thursday morning. From the original farm site north of 245th Street to a new home and foundation on 255th Street, a bit west of Swallow Avenue, the barn made the entire trip between the two sites cross-country over the fields. Matt and Libby Mitchell are the proud new owners of the structure. "We've talked about it for a long time," he said. "We want it back to looking and working the way it did originally. She has plans beyond that. We'll put some cows and pigs in it," she said. Matt Mitchell knows how much work he's in for. He's already restored two other barns. He frequently works with friends Miles Props of Fort Dodge and Alex Stewart of Calendar. While he knows the build date, he's not sure yet who constructed it, although a clue was left behind. "We'll try to figure out who," Matt Mitchell said. "There's a board with names we're going to look over when we set it down. There were probably 1,000 stories that could be told from its 100-plus years of life. If only it could talk," he said. His neighbors easily gave their blessing to the barn being driven over their fields. "There's too many good neighbors to list," he said. "They've all been great." Restoring the barn will be a labor of love. "It's been on the horizon for over 100 years, he said. To tear it down or burn it would have been a tragedy. Traces of its use remain inside. The whole loft was a quarter full, he said. "We pitched it all with a pitchfork. The moving process was done by Vote House Moving of Bradgate. It's all a low, slow, and careful process. The barn was braced, steel support beams put into place, and the building was lifted up, then driven carefully across the fields. Once at the new farm, it was set back down to be slid into place on a new foundation. Mitchell had prepared the field path by driving a blade over it to smooth out the field ruts. Much of his family gathered to watch the slow-motion drive. Among those was his dad, David Mitchell, who was enjoying watching the process and in complete approval of the project. 'Why do this?' he asked. 'For the love of old things and to save some of Iowa.' The Mitchells were also able to get help from the Iowa Barn Foundation. Matt Mitchell said it paid for about half the moving costs. As the barn pulled up next to the new foundation, he still had getting it into place to watch, which he did a bit nervously. 'I haven't slept in a year and a half,' he joked. After the barn was driven into place, there was an important old barn tradition to follow, a big hearty meal of homemade food inside the wood-heated shop building. And yes, there was homemade pie. Crews will be lowering the barn onto the foundation this morning.
Rockwell City's last grocery store is closing. Most of Calhoun County now left without one. Rockwell City is the next victim in a growing list of small rural towns that have lost or are about to lose their only grocery store. The town of about 2,000 learned early this week that Heartland Market, formerly known as Southside Grocery, will soon close, following the chain's closures in Manson, Rolfe, Rockwell City, and soon Manning. The closing will leave most of Calhoun County without a grocery store. A Facebook post Wednesday notified shoppers that the store would close in the next few weeks, offering them 30% off groceries as it started the liquidation process. Owner Nick Graham would not specify the last day for the store. Graham said employees were probably notified last week, but would not recall the exact date they were given notice. Rockwell City Mayor Phil Henlon said that the city received notice from an employee Tuesday that as soon at least the employees apparently said they were told, setting the city in motion to contact chain stores to explore an alternative for the town. Graham's Heartland Market store in Manning will close on Christmas Eve, according to that store's Facebook page. His chain's Manson Grocery Store closed on November 10th, earlier than the date it initially announced as its last day, as it faced the imminent shutdown of electricity due to the non-payment, according to the store's manager. Employees in Manson were notified the store was closing with a note in their paychecks, a manner of notice that sparked anger and disgust among employees. Rockwell City Store employs about 10 people. Like many other towns preceding Rockwell City, the only remaining store to sell just a small selection of groceries will be Dollar General. It's a very tough time to be an independent grocer, especially in small rural America, Graham said. He told the Messenger Thursday, I can't keep going backwards on this. Graham became the youngest grocery store owner in the country in 2006 when he purchased his first grocery store at age 17. The owner of Heartland Markets purchased the store in Rockwell in 2017, along with a string of others in nearby towns. He said the store was there for decades before that. As she picked up a dozen loaves of bread Thursday afternoon, Marcella Hammond always recalled having at least one grocery store in town. As she moved to the town about 35 years ago, she said there was two. Heinlein said the store said that store, Clark's Supermarket, closed about 15 years ago, according to his memory. It was housed in a spot where Swanson's Hardware is now located. In fact, Hammond only realized the store was closing as she pulled the bread off the shelf. She missed the signs on the way in. Recently, she recalled posted signs to contrary, telling shoppers throughout the building that the store was, in fact, not closing. Graham told the Messenger that he believed employees saw the figurative writing on the wall over the past few weeks, even as they taped up signs telling customers the store wasn't closing. The signs giving false hopes to shoppers and employees alike turned out to be untrue after all. After this store closes, his small chain only remaining stores will be in Ackley, Jewell, and Gowrie. The store owner, considered a whiz in the business a decade ago, given his age, said that the declining rural population, e-commerce, and general merchandise stores have contributed to his chain's decline, citing no significant profits in 2017, a slight loss in 2018, and a large loss at the Rockwell City store in 2019. This year has been really difficult, he said, telling the Messenger he hasn't received any paycheck or compensation for nearly 3 years. Officials in Rockwell City, like others, are not happy about the change. Anytime a town that size loses a grocery store, it has a huge effect, said Heinlein. He said upcoming meetings may soon determine whether there's enough viable interest from other grocery store chains to locate in town, providing a substantial option closer than Fort Dodge, which is a 35-minute drive. Can we make that happen? We're going to try like hell, he said. We've made the phone calls, believe me. We're not going to lay down and take this. He said that the town with a substantial elderly population with less mobility will reap substantial consequences without a grocery store. The mayor said no local citizen has expressed interest in running the store, and he doesn't foresee the city showing an interest in undertaking a local co-op that some towns have attempted. The last thing we need to do is get into something like that and have it fail, he said. Such an effort would cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. In addition to a substantial personnel and inventory investment, he said the building owned by Graham has had a few issues. The building closed earlier this week due to a major water leak and has had issues with its heating system and front doors. Small towns are losing some things, Heinlein said, and the reality is that in rural Iowa, they're being forced to accept as the new normal.
A trip of a lifetime. Fort Dodge Senior High cheerleader heading to London. Fort Dodge Senior High School cheerleader Isaac Tripp is preparing for the trip of a lifetime. On December 26th, trip, a senior will fly to London in the United Kingdom, where he will meet up with 750 of the United States' top high school cheerleaders. On New Year's Day, the cheerleaders from the Universal Cheerleaders Association's All-American Cheer Squad will participate in the London New Year's Day Parade. Tripp was selected for the UCA All-American Cheer Squad after trying out last summer during a UCA cheer camp in the Fort Dodge Senior High Squad, which the Senior High Squad attends. Only six cheerleaders from each school are allowed to try out for the squad, and Tripp was selected to try out by Fort Dodge Senior High cheer coach Casey Williams. All 4 years he's been on the squad. And all 4 years, he's made the All-American Squad, which selects only the top 10% of cheerleaders across the country, Williams said. My freshman year, I actually went to Philadelphia through the same program, and I was in the Philadelphia Thanksgiving Day Parade, Tripp said. It introduced me to a whole new cheer experience. I met a lot of people, and it wasn't until that moment that I realized cheer was bigger than just being on the sidelines. In fact, Tripp didn't initially want to be a cheerleader. He was encouraged by friends to try out for the Dodger squad when he was a freshman, but he wasn't interested. I actually didn't want to try out because I was scared of the stereotypes about male cheerleaders and whatnot, he said. But he ultimately ended up trying out, making the team, and finding his niche, he said. Casey kind of took me under her wing and made it a very fun environment for me, Tripp said. About 2 weeks after Tripp returns from London, he will be graduating early and starting classes at Iowa Central Community College, where he hopes to join the cheerleading program in the fall. Williams is proud of Tripp's accomplishments in the cheerleading, and he said he deserves this opportunity. As a coach, I think this is a wonderful experience. Isaac has worked very hard to get top-level elite skills, but even though the skills are what got him the trip, it's going to be the memories and the friendships and the relationships that he's going to carry forward from this trip. I'm excited for him. There's no better person to go there and represent us. Tripp loves meeting new people and having new experiences and is ready to represent the Dodgers in the best way possible. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to go to London and be in one of the biggest parades in the world for New Year's, he said. I'm going to definitely pull a lot of memories away from it. This is Tripp's first trip out of the country, and he knows only one other person on the trip, a cheerleader he knows from Council Bluffs. There's definitely nerves, but overall, I'm ready, he said. I am so excited. Outside of the parade and rehearsal for the parade, the cheerleaders will see a production of the musical Wicked and visit Windsor Castle, among other sightseeing opportunities. But neither of those are what Tripp's been most looking forward to. Riding on the London Eye, he said, referring to the giant illuminated Ferris wheel. I've been so excited for that. Tripp also plans to see London's iconic clock tower outside the Palace of Westminster. Even though it's under construction, he said, who cares? It's Big Ben.
Group backing Joni Ernst hit with complaint after AP story. An election watchdog filed a complaint Thursday alleging that an outside group funded by top political aides to Iowa Senator Joni Ernst violated campaign finance law in an effort to improve the Republicans' chance at re-election next year. The complaint filed with the Federal Elections Commission by the nonpartisan Campaign Legal Center comes after the Associated Press reported earlier this month that Ernst's work with the political nonprofit Iowa Values to raise money and build an electoral firewall potentially violated campaign finance and tax law. Political nonprofits are often referred to as dark money groups because they can raise unlimited sums and do not have to disclose their donors. But such tax-exempt groups are forbidden from making political activity their primary purpose. The complaint requests that the FEC launch an investigation. It also argues that internal Iowa Values documents revealed by the AP show the group's major purpose is political activity. That likely violates the conditions of its tax-exempt status while breaking campaign finance laws that obligate the group to register as a political committee with the FEC and disclose its anonymous donors, the watchdog said. There is a little evidence of Iowa Values engaging in any activities in 2019 other than those aimed at influencing Ernst's re-election, said Campaign Legal Center, who wrote the complaint.
Calhoun County named home base Iowa community, Rockwell City. Calhoun County became the 100th home base Iowa community on Thursday. Home Base Iowa is a program to connect veterans and transitioning service members with more than 2,400 businesses statewide who have pledged to hire over 16,000 veterans. The program has 27 college and university partners. We are excited to be designated as a Home Base Iowa community and honored to have the distinction of being the 100th to join the program, said Jill Heiserkamp, Executive Director of Calhoun County Economic Development. We have two military veterans who serve on our county board of supervisors, so it was important to them and our organization to achieve the designation in support of these men and women who have served. Veterans can find resources on the Home Base Iowa website.
Next, we have a couple of editorials and a couple of letters to the editor. The first editorial is Dancing Their Way to Victory. Triton sweep recent competition while Fort Dodge Senior High also win accolades. Athleticism and artistry were on full display recently when the Iowa Central Community College dance team won 3 first place awards in a statewide competition. During the 44th annual Iowa State Dance Team Association contest in Des Moines, the team swept 3 classes of competition. It was crowned the champion of jazz, hip-hop, and pom categories. In order to do this, they had to not only match their commitment levels each dance, but perform performance quality and execution, said the dance team coach Cassidy Vermeer. During their performances, their chemistry was palatable for the audience. That kind of performance is rare. The bond that our team has is very special. The Triton swept the 3 categories in state competition once before in 2017. Iowa Central has now won 13 consecutive titles in jazz and 7 consecutive titles in pom. The Tritons weren't the only local winners at the competition. Fort Dodge Senior High School earned Division I ratings in hip-hop, jazz, and pom. The Dodgers won 3rd place in hip-hop and 4th place in pom. It is great to have the dance team from Iowa Central and Fort Dodge Senior High bringing home honors from the competition. We congratulate all of the talented dancers and wish them the best of luck in future competitions.
The next editorial is Who We Are Now Will Be Our Legacy. We are in the last days of this year, and many of us will spend at least a portion of them in the company of children we love. Never have I been more mindful of this privilege. Most of us want to believe that we will live on in the memories of the children in our lives. But I wonder how many of us have thought about what our legacy will be. As I write, the House of Representatives is in its 6th hour of 1- and 2-minute speeches in either support of or opposition to the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. By the time you read this column, the President of the United States will have been impeached. He will soon face trial in the Senate, and Republican Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has made no secret of his intentions. "I'm not an impartial juror," he said earlier this week. "This is a political process. There is not anything judicial about it. Impeachment is a political decision. This flies in the face of precedent and procedure. Senators must remain seated and silent throughout the trial. For example, under threat of imprisonment, but he clearly does not care." His Republican colleague, Senator Lindsey Graham, was even more blunt. "I am trying to give a pretty clear signal. I have made up my mind. I am not trying to pretend to be a fair juror here. I will do everything I can to make it die quickly." One common refrain in recent weeks is that history will remember how these members of Congress voted in this time of crisis in our country. But they aren't the only ones who will leave behind a record. In this historical time, families are weaving their own historical narratives. How will we be remembered by the children we leave behind? Our children and grandchildren, our nieces and nephews, they will be adults in a world that is more diverse and inclusive than the one they were born into. Most children grow up to become adults, wondering how much their roots contribute to the complicated people looking back at them in the mirror. Our roots are our beginnings, not our excuses. And these young generations will have plenty of evidence to help them understand the difference. I often wonder how Trump supporters with young children in their lives think they're going to defend their allegiance when their kids are old enough to demand accountability. Most of us have moments when we wince over things we did when our kids were little. Sometimes they're funny, and sometimes we have to apologize and ask forgiveness. But how would I have any credibility in telling a daughter or granddaughter that no man should touch her without her permission if I voted for a man who bragged about being a sexual predator? How would I explain that one? This is something I think about a lot. What if a child we love falls in love with a black person or a Latino? What if they have children? What right would we have to even know these children if we were willing to vote for a racist who regularly described Mexicans as rapists and murderers? How do we, years from now, convince the grown children in our lives that we love their babies when we defended that racist after he separated thousands of young migrant children from their parents at the border? We don't yet know the extent of Trump's legacy, but we know that what he was willing to do to innocent children will be a primary part of any legitimate account of his presidency. If we align ourselves with Trump, what makes us think our children will want anything to do with us? How do we look into their grown-up eyes and tell them his hatred for large swaths of Americans was good for the country? Millions of Americans will gather in churches this Christmas, and the adults will be reminded anew how children make the holiday. They'll stifle laughs during the annual pageants and nativity reenactments and pull the little ones close in the pews as they help them hold their candles during silent night. Grown-ups will choke back tears at the sight of their little hands clasped in prayer and wish they could freeze them in that moment forever. It doesn't work like that, of course. Children grow up and away, and one day they'll be old enough to know who we were and what we stood for in this historical time in our country. It will matter. And that will be our legacy.
Our first letter to the editor is The Lord's Cupboard Says Thank You. As we approach the end of 2019, it is with gratitude I write this letter to express thanks for all who have made donations to The Lord's Cupboard this past year. Whether it be a monetary donation, large or small, or a box or bag of canned and household goods, your donations are what keep us able to serve the food insecure in Webster County. As we soon begin the year 2020, please continue to think of us throughout the year with your giving. We are embarking on a fundraising effort to make our facility handicapped accessible, and your donations will continue to be needed throughout the year. On behalf of myself and the volunteers of the Lord's Cupboard, we wish you a very happy holidays. Joni Ham Olson, Director of the Lord's Cupboard in Fort Dodge.
And the last letter to the editor says Democrats' effort to remove Trump will fail. After 3 years, Democrats in control of the House of Representatives finally made good on their efforts to impeach President Trump. Don't kid yourself. House Democrats Nancy Pelosi, Jerry Nadler, and Adam Schiff are not sincere when they stand before the microphones and say Democrats are sad and take no pleasure in impeaching Trump. During the last days of the hearing held by the House of Judiciary Committee, some Democrats were seen paying more attention to their cell phones than the hearing proceedings, and Chairman Nadler fell asleep at least twice. Democrats have spoken openly and vehemently of their desire to impeach Trump, and some, like House Democrats Maxine Waters and Al Green, were calling for impeachment in Trump's first year in office. Many of the first-term Democrats newly elected to the House in 2018 were calling for impeachment. I remember in particularly Representative Rashad Tlaib, Democrat, Michigan, who shortly after being sworn in stated, "We're going to go in there, we're going to impeach the explicit." When President Clinton, a Democrat, was impeached in December of 1998, the House was controlled by Republicans. With bipartisan voting, some House Democrats voting for, some House Republicans voting against, Clinton was impeached on two articles, one of perjury to a grand jury and one of obstruction of justice. A second charge of perjury and a charge of abuse of power failed to pass the House. Clinton was then acquitted in the Senate, where 67 votes, Republicans held only 55 seats, were needed to remove Clinton from office, and where not one Democrat voted guilty on either charge. So, with majority control in the House, the Democrats voted to impeach. But unlike with Clinton in 1998, this vote in the House to impeach Trump was not on a bipartisan basis. No Republican voted to impeach. Now it is on to the Senate, where the Democrats are in the minority. But that is not likely to matter because of the need of 67 votes. While the Democrats are giddy about their drive to impeach Trump in the House, their effort to overturn the 2016 election will fail in the Senate. The resistance to Trump will continue full speed ahead. I believe the Democrats will do anything they can in the 2020 election year to undermine growth in the economy and the creation of jobs, and will oppose most anything Trump wants to do. Chuck Peterson, Fort Dodge.
This date in history. Today is Friday, December 20th, the 354th day of 2019. There are 11 days left in the year. Today's highlights. On December 20th, 1803, the Louisiana Purchase was completed as ownership of the territory was formally transferred from France to the United States. On this date, in 1860, South Carolina became the first state to secede from the Union as all 169 delegates to a special convention in Charleston voted in favor of separation. In 1924, Adolf Hitler was released from prison after serving 9 months for his role in the Beer Hall Purchase. In 1961, playwright-director Moss Hart, 57, died in Palm Springs, California. In 1968, author John Steinbeck died in New York City at 66. In 1978, former White House Chief of Staff H.R. Haldeman was released from prison after serving 18 months for his role in the Watergate cover-up. In 1995, NATO started its peacekeeping mission, taking over the United Nations. In 1999, the Vermont Supreme Court ruled that homosexual couples were entitled to the same benefits and protections as wedded heterosexual couples. In 2002, Trent Lott resigned as Senate Republican leader 2 weeks after igniting a political firestorm with racially charged remarks. The nation's 10 biggest brokerages agreed to pay $1.44 billion and fundamentally changed the way they did business to settle allegations they'd misled investors by hyping certain companies' stocks. 10 years ago, actress Brittany Murphy, who'd starred in Clueless and 8 Miles, died at age 32. 5 years ago, a gunman who announced online he was planning to shoot 2 pigs in retaliation for police chokehold death of Eric Gardner ambushed 2 New York City officers in a patrol car. Ishmael Brinsley shot Rafael Ramos and Weijing Liu to death before running to a subway station and killing himself. 1 year ago, President Donald Trump announced that Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, who had differed with Trump on Syria, Afghanistan, and ties to NATO, would retire at the end of February. In a resignation letter, Mattis said Trump observed a defense chief whose views are better aligned with yours. Days later, Trump pushed Mattis out 2 months earlier than planned. The thought for today, all the mistakes I've ever made were when I wanted to say no and said yes.
You are listening to the Fort Dodge Messenger on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Disabled. The Messenger can be heard daily at 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. If you have any questions or comments about our program or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833 And now we turn to today's obituaries.
Jolene Seavers. Jolene D. Seavers, 81, formerly of Humboldt, passed away December 18, 2019, at Brighton Gardens, Kansas City. Jolene Dorothy Schultz was born on a farm in Hanover Township, Crawford County, Iowa, on October 3, 1938, to Leonard and Dorothy Knopp Schultz. She attended country schools through third grade and then transferred to the Schleswig, Iowa school system, graduating valedictorian of her class in 1956. She attended the Ellis School of Cosmetology in Sioux City, obtaining her cosmetology license. Jolene married Harlow Seavers on November 23, 1958 at Emmanuel Lutheran in Schleswig. To this union, they were blessed with the birth of their daughter, Kelly. They have lived in Denison, Fort Dodge, and Humboldt, and retired to a beautiful home overlooking Table Rock Lake in Branson, Missouri in 1998. They lived in Branson for 17 years until they moved to the Kansas City area to be closer to Kelly and their granddaughters because of Jolene's health. During her lifetime, she served on several boards, such as the president of the Humboldt County Hospital Auxiliary, Christian Women, treasurer of Zion Methodist Women's Group, Humboldt County American Cancer Society Board, and VP of the LWML in Branson. Jolene will always be known for loving her Lord, her family, and her friends. Preceding her in death were her parents, two brothers, Milford and Lorenz, sister-in-law, Joydeen Schultz, and her nephew, Brad Schultz. Surviving her is her husband of 61 years, Harlow, her daughter, Kelly of Kansas City, two granddaughters, Chandler and Paxton of Kansas City, brother Roger Maria Schultz of Sioux City, brother-in-law Harold Seavers of The Village in Florida, and several nieces and nephews. The visitation will be 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. today at Laufensweiler Seavers Funeral Home. The funeral will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, December 21st at Zion Lutheran Church, Humboldt. An additional visitation will be from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. Saturday at the Huebner Funeral Home in Schleswig. Burial will follow at Morgan Township Cemetery near Schleswig.
Retta Hanselman, West Bend. Retta Hanselman, 99, of West Bend, died Wednesday at the West Bend Care Center. Services will be Monday, December 23rd, 11 o'clock a.m. at Peace Lutheran Church, West Bend, with burial to follow in the West Bend Cemetery. Visitation is from 9 to 11, Monday, at the church. Harris Funeral Home is assisting the family.
Ruby B. Johnson. Ruby B. Johnson, 91, of Fort Dodge, passed away on Wednesday, December 18, 2019, at Friendship Haven. Services will be 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, December 21, 2019, at the Gunderson Funeral Chapel. Burial will be in the North Lawn Cemetery. Visitation will be from 9:30 a.m. until the time of the service on Saturday at Gunderson Funeral Home and Cremation Services in Fort Dodge. Ruby Bell Weiskup, the daughter of Ralph and Mabel Weiskup, was born December 8, 1928 in Boone, Iowa. On February 18, 1949, Ruby was united in marriage to E. Thomas Johnson in Boone. Ruby and Tom made their home and farm near Burnside, Iowa, until they moved to Kenyon Place at Friendship Haven in Fort Dodge. Ruby also worked at Trinity Regional Hospital in Fort Dodge. She enjoyed oil painting, quilting, knitting, and many other art crafts. What she loved the most in life was serving God and taking care of her family. Her husband passed away on March 6, 2008. Ruby is survived by her five children, Joanne, Harold, Koff of Birmingham, Alabama, Steve Johnson of Fort Dodge, Noreen Conrad Kishner of Astolain, Wisconsin, Dale Laura Johnson of Lehigh, and Carolyn Harold Thomas of Castle Plains, Colorado. Eight grandchildren, 15 great-grandchildren, her sister Marjorie Moffat of Indianola, Iowa. She was preceded in death by her husband Tom, her parents, and two siblings, Alice Walgren and Lawrence Weiskup. Online condolences are for the family may be offered at www.gundersonfuneralhome.com.
John E. Mesher. John Mesher, 75, died Tuesday, December 17, 2019, at the Paula J. Baber Hospice Unit following a courageous battle with cancer. A funeral mass will be held Saturday at 10:30 a.m. at St. Cecilia Catholic Church in Algona, with burial at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 today at Oak Crest Funeral Services of Algona, with the scripture prayer service beginning at 7 p.m. Oak Crest Funeral Services Algona is assisting the family. For online condolences and obituaries, the website is www.oakcrestfuneralservices.com.
Merle J. Klinger. Merle J. Klinger, 97, of Fort Dodge, formerly of Farmerville and Summers, passed away Thursday, December 19, 2019, at the Simpson Health Center, Friendship Haven, Fort Dodge, Iowa. Services are pending at Palmer Funeral Home, Gowrie.
Richard Elsbecker, Algona. A mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Monday, St. Cecilia Catholic Church, Algona. Visitation is 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. Sunday, St. Cecilia Catholic Church.
Rich Barnett. Memorial services will be 2 p.m. Monday, Faber and Ottoman Funeral Home, Sac City. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service at the funeral home.
Gunderson Funeral Home is serving the families of Ruby Johnson today, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at Gunderson's. Visitation, 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday at Gunderson's. Alice Barber, 1:30 p.m. Sunday at Gunderson's. And Lofusweiler's Seavers Funeral Home is serving the family of Jolene D. Seavers, age 81. Funeral, 10:30 Saturday, Zion Lutheran Church, Humboldt, and visitation from 4 to 6 today at Lofusweiler's Seavers Funeral Home.
Farm ethanol groups angered at final EPA ethanol rule. Some farm groups and farm state lawmakers expressed anger at the Trump administration Thursday over final ethanol rules that said they failed to uphold the president's promises to the industry. The Environmental Protection Agency released its final renewable fuel standard, but it did not include language that President Donald Trump agreed to in meetings with the industry officials. Iowa's governor and congressional representatives during September and October. Apparently, President Trump doesn't care about his promise to Iowa's farmers, said Iowa Corn Growers Association President Jim Greif. He had the opportunity to tell his EPA to stick to the deal that was made on October 4th. The final agreement does not include language Trump agreed to that the EPA would add ethanol gallons back into the nation's gasoline supply based on the exemptions granted in the past 3 years. Instead, the final rule says EPA will base oil refinery exemptions on Energy Department recommendations. The ethanol industry and corn farmers who raise the grain that's made into ethanol said the agreed-upon language would have created market certainty by assuring the industry that it would meet the 15 billion gallons, 56.78 billion liters, of corn-based ethanol for 2020 mandated by federal renewable fuel standard law. Roughly 40% of U.S. corn is used to produce ethanol, so fewer ethanol gallons mean a reduced market for corn. The EPA issued 85 retroactive small refinery exemptions for the 2016 to 2018 compliance years, undercutting the renewable fuel volumes by a total of 4 billion gallons, according to Renewable Fuels Association. Ethanol and corn industry groups said that the language in the rule leaves too much to the whim of the federal bureaucrats and could cause ethanol fuel could cause ethanol use to fall short. Ethanol industry officials have said that at least 20 U.S. ethanol plants have closed, at least temporarily, since September 2018. Due in part to the reduction of the ethanol use in the nation's fuel supply because of the EPA policy. Instead of certainty, we are essentially being told to trust the EPA to uphold the RFS in the future, even though for the past 3 years the EPA has routinely undermined the program, said the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association Executive Director Monty Shaw, who accused Trump of turning his back on farmers. "Every farmer and biofuel supporter I have talked to has deeply disappointed, frustrated, and frankly angry. I don't think the White House only truly understands the depth of discontent in the farm country." The EPA said it has modified its refinery exemptions policy to ensure the mandatory biofuels volume are met, and contends that Trump administration has fulfilled the key promise to farmers and industry. "President Trump committed to our nation's national farmers that biofuel requirements would be expanded in 2020. At the EPA, we are delivering on that promise and ensuring a net of 15 billion gallons of conventional biofuels are blended into the nation's fuel supply," EPA Administrator Andrew Wheeler said in a statement. Other critics hesitated to point the finger directly at Trump, but indicated deep distrust that the EPA would uphold the law. "I would like to say I could trust the EPA will follow with the rule, but this agency continues to side with the oil industry," said David Burns, a friend Nebraska farmer and a chairman of the Nebraska Corn Board. He said the final rule also fails to include 500 million gallons of biofuels that the federal court in 2017 ordered EPA to restore back into the nation's fuel supply. Republican Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds refrained from criticizing Trump, but said, "Wheeler should know that we are not done holding him to the agreement we've reached with President Trump in the Oval Office on September 12th. Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa was in one of the White House meetings when the agreement was struck, and the final rule does not reflect the agreement. Once again, EPA is playing games and not helping President Trump with farmers," he said.
In brief, after impeachment, House bestows big trade victory on Trump. One day after its historic impeachment votes, the Democratic-led House gave President Donald Trump an overwhelming bipartisan victory Thursday on a renegotiated trade agreement with Canada and Mexico. By a 385-41 vote, the House approved a bill that puts in place terms of the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. The legislation passed after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat California, and her colleagues won a key concession from an administration anxious to pass the trade deal before next year's election season makes that task more difficult. The deal is projected to have only a modest impact on the economy, but it gives lawmakers from both parties the chance to support an agreement sought by farmers, ranchers, and business owners anxious to move past the months of trade tensions that have complicated spending and hiring decisions. The GOP-controlled Senate probably will take up the legislation when the members return to Washington after the holidays and after dealing with impeachment.
Police search for suspect after one shot at Oklahoma City Mall. A man shot another man Thursday during an argument outside an Oklahoma City Mall, and police were searching stores for the suspect while also clearing out shoppers still hiding. Sergeant Chris Gullenbeck said the victim was hospitalized in critical condition after being shot in the upper body. The shooting occurred in one of the walkways of the Penn Square Mall. Police said in a tweet that the suspect, wearing a sweatpants but no shirt, was seen fleeing from the area around the Foot Locker store. Gellenbeck said it was not known if he had left the mall or had hunkered down somewhere inside. When the shooting started, there were bunches of people hidden in closets, behind back rooms, and locked in stores, Gellenbeck said. So we're having to go store to store to clear the civilians out looking for the suspect.
Science says diet plays a big role in how huge whales can get. Whales are big, but why aren't they bigger? A new study says it's basically about how many calories they can take in. That's the conclusion of researchers who use small boats to chase down 300 whales of various species around the world. They reached out with long poles to attach sensors to the creatures with suction cups, allowing them to record what the animals were doing on their dives for food. The results suggest body size is controlled by how whales capture prey and how much food is available, researchers reported Thursday in the journal Science. The study included 90 blue whales, the biggest animal ever lived. Size estimates vary, but the American Cetacean Society says blue whales can grow about 100 feet long and weigh more than 100 tons. The study also included the biggest whale with teeth, the sperm whale, which can stretch about 60 feet long, the group says. When toothed whales hunt, they capture one prey at a time, seeking them out in the murky depths of a sonar-like detection. The study found that as body size increases in such whales, they become progressively less efficient as they hunt. They recover fewer calories from their meals per calorie burned in each dive. That results from limits on availability of prey. It looks like you cannot be much bigger than a sperm whale when hunting the way it does, says Nicholas Pison of the Smithsonian's National Museum of Natural History, who was part of the research. The blue whale can be bigger because it feeds in as a much different and highly efficient way, the study says. It opens its mouth wide and engulfs an immense volume of water, even bigger than its body size, as it swims along. Then it closes its mouth and strains the water out through a sieve-like filter, which traps huge amounts of tiny shrimp-like creatures called krill. That allows them to exploit a very large prey resource that's very rich in the small amount of time, says Jeremy Goldberg of Stanford University, another researcher. They get a huge bang for the buck. So why aren't they even bigger than they are? Maybe blue whales are limited by the seasonal nature of the most nutritious krill patches, which grow gigantic and dense in the summer, Goldbogen said, and calculations indicate that to sustain a blue whale that's 115 feet long, you'd need a density of prey that is just not seen anywhere in the world. But maybe there's also some kind of limiting factor in how their bodies function. He noted a recent study that found a blue whale's heart beats up to 37 times a minute after deep dives, and that appears to be about as fast as the organ can pump. Another limiting factor could be the whale's ability to process the food it takes in. The study is provided a comprehensive look across big whale species, and the success of collecting the data boggles the mind. You try to go out and put a tiny tag on the back of the biggest animal in the world.
Next, we're going to read Go and Do. In Fort Dodge, lights at Kennedy is from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. today, Saturday, and Sunday at the John F. Kennedy Memorial Park Campground, 1415 Nelson Avenue. The cost is $5 per vehicle. Profits will be donated to the Backpack Buddies program. Santa Claus will be handing out candy canes. The Blandon Memorial Art Gallery, 920 3rd Avenue South, is holding youth art classes. Metal Magic Journal. Saturday classes for 6 to 10-year-olds is at 10 a.m. to noon, and classes for 11 to 16-year-olds is from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. Class sizes are limited to 12 students in each session. Cost is $10 for members and $15 for non-members. In Fort Dodge, the Webster County Birding is holding a Christmas bird count from 6:30 a.m. to noon Saturday. Meet at Tom Thumb, 1412 A Street, for breakfast and coordinates. Noon location will be announced at breakfast. Call Breck at 222-3992 for more information. Soldier Creek Winery, 1584 Paragon, is holding a Vineyard Vibrations from 6 to 8 p.m. today. Free live music will be provided by Jive for Five. Food will be available for purchase. Home for Christmas with Ben Ayers will be 7:30 p.m. Saturday at the Opera House at the Fort Museum and Frontier Village. Doors will open at 6:45 p.m. There will be a meet and greet session following the show. Tickets are $30 for adults and $20 for students and may be purchased at First American Bank or online at homeforchristmas.ticketapp.com tickets. Proceeds from the concert will support the Fort Dodge Area Fine Arts Association and Fort Dodge Senior High Vocal Music Booster Club. McSweeney's School for Performing Arts Flute Recital is 2 p.m. Sunday at the school at 1633 North 29th Street. Admission is free. Fort Frenzy, 3232 First Avenue South, will host Santa from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday. Take your picture with Santa and the Grinch. Enter for a chance to win a Frenzy Family Pack. In Fort Dodge, Elias Netz will perform from 7 to 9 p.m. Saturday at River Hops Brewing, 1014 Central Avenue. Admission is free. In Webster City, the KYL will play The Grinch. It will present the movie The Grinch from 10:30 a.m. to noon Saturday at the library. Festival Trees is set in Lorenz. The 20th annual Lorenz Festival of Trees is noon to 7 p.m. Saturday and Sunday at the Lorenz United Methodist Church. Admission is free will donation.
Hawaii law enforcement to stand down from telescope site, Honolulu. Hawaii officials are having police leave a mountain where protesters are blocking construction of a giant telescope because the project isn't moving forward for now. An international consortium wants to build the 30-meter telescope on Mauna, Hawaii's tallest peak, but some native Hawaiians believe the telescope would desecrate sacred land. Protesters have stopped construction from going forward since mid-July. Telescope builders informed the state it is not prepared to move forward with construction at this time, according to a memo Thursday from Governor David Igg's office. But that doesn't mean the embattled 30-meter telescope will move to an alternate site in Spain's Canary Islands. Construction likely wouldn't have moved forward during the winter months anyway. Igg expressed his severe disappointment that TMT will not move forward for now, despite months of often intense behind-the-scenes discussions among protesters, telescope owners, and state and county officials. The memo by the governor's chief of staff, Linda Chow Takema, whose efforts will continue, and the governor anticipates that activities on the project will resume in the future. Telescope officials didn't immediately comment. Igg is scheduled to hold a news conference Thursday. The stand down did not appear to have taken effect as of 8 a.m., the Honolulu Star Advisor reported, noting that a half dozen vehicles belonging to state law enforcement officers remain parked above the barricade on the Mauna Kea access road as about 30 protesters chanted and danced hula. The Spanish island of La Palma, which already hosts several powerful telescopes at the Roque de los Muchachos Observatory, was chosen as a backup site for the telescope in 2016. Scientists say Mauna Kea is a more desirable site. Mauna Kea's summit was selected because the weather and air conditions there are among the best in the world for viewing the skies. The telescope would give researchers a view back to the deepest reaches of our universe and allow them to examine the time immediately following the Big Bang.
Scientists narrow age estimate for fossils of human ancestors. Scientists say that they have finally calculated the age of the youngest known remains of Homo erectus, which is generally considered an ancestor of our species. The fossil skull fragments and other bones were uncovered on the Indonesian island of Java in the 1930s. Determining their age has been a scientific challenge, and a wide range has been proposed by numerous studies. In a report released Wednesday by the journal Nature, scientists concluded that the remains are between 108,000 and 117,000 years old. Researchers used 5 dating techniques on sediments and fossil animal bones from the area, combining 52 age estimates for the analysis. The project took 13 years to complete. "I don't see any way to date this site more thoroughly," said the paleontologist Russell Shion of University of Iowa, an author of the study. H. erectus arose in Africa about 2 million years ago and spread widely there and in Asia, and possibly into Europe. It reached Java more than 1.5 million years ago, and the new dates suggest that it died out at least 35,000 years before the arrival of our own species, Homo sapiens. The H. erectus may have been doomed on Java by climate changes that turned its open woodland environment into a rainforest. He said, still, it evidently existed longer on Earth than any other species in our Homo branch of evolutionary tree. Susan Anton, a New York University anthropologist who did not participate in the work, called the dating effort heroic, but she said that she considered the reported age to be too narrow. She said she preferred a span of less than 550,000 years old to more than 100,000 years old. That is roughly what she and co-author proposed in a paper published in 2011. The younger end of the range in that paper is recent as 120,000 years, which she said is virtually the same as the new result.
We're running short on time, so I'm going to jump to sports, where there's an article called Late Charge. Rams win final five matches to take showdown. After the Fort Dodge wrestling team came up short against Southeast Polk here on Thursday night, head coach Bobby Thompson immediately began to look ahead. Thompson is more concerned about how his Dodgers will respond to get to where they need to be 2 months from now. In a top five showdown, it was Southeast Polk who pulled away for a 37-19 victory over the Dodgers, the new top-ranked squad in the tournament rankings over the number two Rams. Southeast Polk is number one in the Iowa Wrestling Tourney top 10, while the Dodgers are fourth. We have some good individual results, but as a team, we have a long way to go. We did win some pivotal matches in the middle of the lineup, Thompson said. We just didn't match up well with them overall. They controlled the ties, which forced some stalling calls. It's only December 19th, so we need to go into break and work on some things and strive to keep getting better. Fort Dodge came away with five victories on the night, winning three ranked matchups with a lineup that included three first-time varsity wrestlers and one jumping up a weight to combat the illness that has spread through the lineup.
Dodgers are settling in for the long haul. This is an article by Eric Pratt. The Fort Dodge wrestling team isn't there yet, but if Thursday's duel with top-ranked Southeast Polk is any indication, the Dodgers aren't going anywhere either. The deceptive 37-19 loss to the Rams in an electric Fort Dodge Senior High gym environment gave head coach Bobby Thompson's squad plenty to both work with and work on moving forward. Southeast Polk put the hammer down on the evening's final matches to erase a 19-15 deficit at Waits, where they should have held a district advantage over the Dodgers. Yes, the Rams were better top to bottom at this point, especially in a head-to-head showdown like last night's CIML, Iowa Conference opener for both programs. There is no official dual team rankings yet, but it's clear Southeast Polk is a few steps ahead of Fort Dodge at this stage of the game. All hope is not lost for the Dodgers, though, who have obviously developed an early toughness and callus for the placing third in a powerhouse in tournaments at Independence and Council Bluffs.
That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Fort Dodge Messenger. We thank the folks at Friendship Haven for giving Iris a home in Fort Dodge for so many years, and we thank you for listening with Iris, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Wishing you all a dream to bless and a star to guide.